This is Chapter Day. I'm Jim Fleming. I'm starting a new novel today from an author whose books we have read from several times on this program, Maeve Binchy. This one is called Evening Class, and we'll read from it for several weeks. Evening Class by Maeve Binchy, Chapter 1. There was a time back in 1970 when they would love filling in a questionnaire. Aidan might find one in a newspaper at a weekend. Are you a thoughtful husband? Or possibly, what do you know about showbiz? They scored high on the answers to, are you well suited? And how well do you treat your friends? But that was long ago. The page would be turned nowadays if either of them saw a survey asking, are you compatible? And there had been no row, no falling out. Aidan had not been unfaithful to Nell, and he assumed that she had not strayed either. It had been so long now since Nell had asked about his job and his hopes and dreams in the school. There was a time when she had known the name of every teacher and many of the pupils, when she would talk about the large classes and the post of responsibility and the school excursions and plays, about Aidan's projects for the Third World. But now she hardly knew what was happening. When the new Minister for Education was appointed, well, Nell just shrugged. I suppose she can't be worse than the last one, was her only comment. He had become very dull explaining things. He could hear his own voice echoing in his ears. There was a kind of drone to it, and his daughters would raise their eyes to heaven, wondering why at the ages of 21 and 19 they should have to listen to any of this. Oh, he tried not to bore them. Aidan knew it was a characteristic of teachers. They were so used to the captive audience in the classroom, they could go on for far too long, approaching every subject from several sides until they were sure that the listener had grasped the drift. He made huge efforts to key into their lives. But Nell never had any stories or any issues to discuss about the restaurant where she worked as a cashier. Ah, for heaven's sake, Aidan, it's a job. I sit there and I take their credit cards or their checks or their cash and I give them change in a receipt. And then at the end of the day I come home and at the end of the week I get my wages and that's the way it is for 90% of the world. We don't have issues and dramas and power struggles. We're normal. That's all. It was not intended to wound him or put him down, but still it was a slap in the face. It was obvious that he himself must have been going on and on about confrontations and conflicts in the staff room. Aidan ached for the companionship, the solidarity and the teamwork of other times. Perhaps when he became principal, it would return. Or was this fooling himself? Possibly the headship would still hold little interest for his wife and two daughters. Grania worked in the bank, but had little to report from it, to her father at any rate. Sometimes he came across her talking to her friends, and she seemed much more animated. And it was the same with Bridget. The travel agency was fine, Dad, stop going on about it. And of course it's fine, and the free holiday twice a year, and the long lunch hours, because three girls covered 2 hours. Grania didn't want to talk about the whole system of banking and whether it was unfair to encourage people to take loans that they would find difficult to repay. She didn't invent the rule, she told him. She had an in basket on her desk and she dealt with what was in it each day. That was it. Dead simple. Bridget didn't have any views on whether the travel trade was selling tourists some kind of dream it could never deliver. Dad, if they don't want a holiday, nobody's twisting their arms. They don't have to come in and buy one. Aidan wished he were more observant. When had all this happened, this growing apart? He could not sit down with his wife and two daughters, the people he loved most in the world, and tell them his fears that he might not be made principal. He had put in so much time in that school, worked so many extra hours, involved himself in every aspect of it, and somewhere in his bones he felt that he would be passed over. Another man almost precisely his own age might well get the post. This was Tony O'Brien, a man who never stayed on after hours to support a school team playing a home match, a man who had not involved himself in the restructuring of the curriculum, in the fundraising for the new building project. Tony O'Brien, who smoked quite openly in the corridors of a school that was meant to be a smoke-free zone, who had his lunch in a pub, letting everyone know it was a pint and a half and a cheese sandwich. A bachelor, in no sense a family man, often seen with a girl half his age on his arm, and yet he was being suggested as a very possible successor as head of the school. There was a questionnaire in one of the Sunday papers. Are you tense? Aidan filled in the answers truthfully. He scored over 75 on the scale, which he knew was high. He wasn't, however, quite prepared for the terse and dismissive verdict. If you scored over 70, you are, in fact, a clenched fist. Lighten up, friend, before you explode. They'd always said that these tests were just jokes, really. Space fillers. That's what Aidan and Nell used to say when they emerged as less well than they hoped from a questionnaire. But this time, of course, he was on his own. Oh, Aidan knew he was jumpy, that was one thing, but a clenched fist? No wonder they might think twice about him as headmaster material. Sundays were the days that Aidan now found hardest to bear. In the past, when they were a real family, a happy family, they had gone on picnics in the summer and taken healthy, bracing walks when the weather was cold. Aidan boasted that his family would never be like those Dublin families who didn't know anywhere except the area they lived themselves. One Sunday he would take them on a train south, and they would climb Bray Head and look into the neighboring county of Wicklow. Another Sunday they would go north to the seaside villages of Rush and Lusk and Skerries, small places, each with its own character, all on the road that would eventually take them up to the border. He had arranged day excursions in Belfast for them, too, so they would not grow up in ignorance of the other part of Ireland. Those had been some of his happiest times, the combination of schoolteacher and father, explainer and entertainer. Daddy knew the answer to everything. Where to get the bus out of Carrickfergus Castle, or the Ulster Folk Museum, and a grand place for chips before getting on the train back home. Aidan remembered a woman on the train telling Grania and Bridget that they were lucky little girls to have a daddy who taught them so much. They had nodded solemnly to agree with her, and Nell had whispered to him that the woman had obviously fancied Aidan, but she wasn't going to get her hands on him. And Aidan had felt 12 feet tall and the most important man on earth. Now, on a Sunday, he felt increasingly that he was hardly noticed in his home. They had never been people for the traditional Sunday lunch, roast beef or lamb or chicken and great dishes of potatoes and vegetables, the way so many other families were. Because of their outings and adventures, Sunday had been casual day in their home. Aidan wished that there was some fixed point in it. He went to Mass. Nell sometimes came with him, but usually she was going on somewhere afterward to meet one of her sisters or a friend from work. And, of course, nowadays the shops were open on Sundays, so there were plenty of places to go. The girls never went to Mass. It was useless to talk to them. He'd given up when they were 17. They didn't get up until lunchtime, and then they made sandwiches, looked at whatever they'd videotaped during the week, lounged around in dressing gowns, washed their hair, their clothes, spoke on the phone to friends, asked other friends in for coffee. Aidan wondered how Tony O'Brien spent his Sundays. He knew that Tony certainly didn't go to Mass. He'd made that clear to the pupils when they questioned him. Sir, do you go to Mass on Sundays? Oh, sometimes I do, when I feel in the mood for talking to God, Tony O'Brien had said. Aidan knew this. It had been reported gleefully by the boys and girls, who used it as ammunition against those who said they had to go every Sunday under pain of mortal sin. On a Sunday, Tony O'Brien probably got up late. He lived in what they called a townhouse nowadays, which was the equivalent of a flat. Just one big room and kitchen downstairs and one big bedroom and bathroom upstairs. The door opened straight onto the street. He'd been observed, leaving in the morning, accompanied by young women. There was a time when that would have ended his career, let alone his chances of promotion. Back in the 1960s, teachers had been sacked for having relationships outside marriage. Not, of course, that this was right. In fact, they'd all protested very strongly at the time, but still, a man who never committed to any woman, to parade a succession of them through his townhouse and still be considered headmaster material, a role model for the students, well, that wasn't right either. What would Tony O'Brien be doing now at 2:30 on a wet Sunday? Maybe around to lunch at one of the other teachers' houses. Aidan had never been able to ask him, since they literally didn't have lunch, and Nell would reasonably have inquired why he should impose on them a man he'd been denouncing for 5 years. He might still be entertaining a lady from last night. Oh, Aidan Dunn was a fair man. He had to admit that people had a choice in such matters. Tony O'Brien didn't drag these women back to his townhouse by their hair. There was no law that said he should be married and bring up two distant daughters, as Aidan had done. Certainly Aidan's Sundays would be nothing that would interest anyone. When he came back from late Mass around 1 o'clock and asked, "Would anyone like a bacon and egg?" there was a chorus of disgust from his daughters. "God, no, Daddy, or Daddy, please don't even mention something like that. And could you keep the kitchen door closed if you're going to have one?" If Nell were at home, she might raise her eyes from a novel and ask why. Her tone was never hostile, only bewildered, as if it were the most unlikely suggestion that had ever been made. Left to herself, Nell might make a salad sandwich at 3. Aidan thought back wistfully to his mother's table, where the chat of the week took place, and no one was excused without a very good reason. Of course, dismantling this had been all his own doing. Making them into free spirits, who would discover the length and breadth of County Dublin, and even the neighboring counties on their one full day off. How could he have known it would lead to his being displaced and restless, wandering from the kitchen where everyone heated up their own food in a microwave, to the sitting room where there was some program that he didn't want to see on television, to the bedroom where it was so long since he had made love with his wife he could barely endure looking at it until it was time to go to sleep. There was, of course, the dining room, the room with the heavy dark furniture that they'd hardly used since they bought the house. Even if they had been people who entertained, it was too small and pokey. Once or twice recently, Nell had suggested, casually, that Aidan should make it into a study for himself. But he'd resisted. He felt that if he turned it into a copy of his room at the school, he might somehow lose his identity as head of this house, as father, provider, and a man who once believed that this was the center of the world. "Did you have a good weekend?" Tony O'Brien asked him in the staff room. Aidan looked quite surprised. It was so long since anyone had inquired. "Oh, quiet, you know," Aidan said. "Well, well, lucky you. I was at a party last night and I'm suffering after it. Still, only 3.5 hours till the good old rehydrating lunchtime pint," Tony groaned. "Aren't you marvelous? The stamina, I mean." Aidan hoped the bitterness and criticism were not too obvious in his voice. As they walked together along the corridors of Mountain View College, the children ran past them, some of them chorusing, "Good morning," others looking sullenly away. Aidan Dunn knew them all, and their parents, and remembered many of their elder brothers and sisters. Tony O'Brien knew hardly any of them. It was so unfair. And that was the afternoon that Mr. Walsh called him into the principal's office. He was a man whose retirement could not come quick enough. Today, for the first time, there was no small talk. "Oh, you and I feel the same about a lot of things, Aidan." "I hope so, Mr. Walsh." "Yes, we look at the world from the same viewpoint. But it's not enough." "I don't know exactly what you mean." And Aidan spoke only the truth. Was this a philosophical discussion? Was it a warning, a reprimand? "It's the system, you see, the way they run things. The principal doesn't have a vote. Sits there like a bloody eunuch, that's what it amounts to." A vote? Aidan thought he knew where this was going, but decided to pretend not to. It had been a wrong calculation. It only annoyed the principal. "Come on, man, you know what I'm talking about. The job, man." "Well, yes," Aidan now felt foolish. "I'm a non-voting member of the Board of Management. I don't have a say. If I did, you'd be in this job in September. But, well, I think you're the man with the values and the sense of what's right for the school." "Thank you, Mr. Walsh. That's very good to know." "Man, will you listen to me before you mouth these things? There's nothing to thank me for. I can't do anything for you. That's what I'm trying to tell you, Aiden." The man looked at him despairingly, as if Aiden were some very slow-learning child in first year. "Wouldn't be the end of the world, you know, supposing you didn't get it." No, absolutely not. I mean, you're a family man, many compensations. Lots of life going on at home, not wedded to this place like I was for so long." Mr. Walsh had been a widower for many years. His only son visited him, but rarely. "I'm utterly right, just as you say," Aiden said. "But..." The older man looked kind, approachable. Aiden spoke slowly. "You're right. It's not the end of the world. Oh, but I suppose I thought, hoped, that it might be a new beginning. Liven everything up in my own life. I wouldn't mind the extra hours. I never did. I spent a lot of hours here already, and in a way I am a bit like you, you know. Wedded to Mountain View." "I know you are." Mr. Walsh was gentle. "I suppose it's Tony O'Brien." "Well, he seems to be the one they want. Nothing definite yet. Not till next week, but that's where their thinking lies." At home, he found Nell in her black dress and yellow scarf, the uniform she wore for work in the restaurant. "But you don't work Monday night," he cried in dismay. "Oh, they were shorthanded, and I thought, why not? There's nothing on television," she said. He wouldn't have told her anyway. Maybe it was better that Nell was going out. "Are the girls home?" he asked. "Oh, Grania's taken possession of the bathroom. Heavy date tonight, apparently." "Anyone we know?" He didn't know why he said it. He could see her irritation. "How would it be anyone we know?" "I'll be off now." "Fine, take care." His voice was flat. "Are you all right, Aiden? Would it matter all that much if I were or I weren't?" "Well, now, what kind of an answer is that? There's very little point in asking you a civil question, if that's all the response I get." "I mean it. Does it matter?" "Not if you're going to put on this self-pitying thing. We're all tired, Aiden. Life's hard for everyone. Why do you think you're the only one with problems?" "Well, what problems do you have? You never tell me. And I'm sure as hell not going to tell you now, with only 3 minutes before the bus." And she was gone. He made a cup of instant coffee and sat down at the kitchen table. Bridget came in. She was dark-haired, freckled like he was, but fortunately less square. Her elder sister had Nell's blonde good looks. "Daddy, it's not fair. She's been in the bathroom for nearly an hour. She was home at 5:30 and she went in at 6, and now it's nearly 7. Daddy, tell her to get out and let me in." "No," he said quietly. What do you mean, no?" Bridget was startled. "You're grown-up women. Sort out the bathroom between you," he said, and walked out with his coffee into the dining room, closing the door behind him. He sat still for a while and looked around him. It seemed to signify all that was wrong with the life they lived. There were no happy family meals around this big, bleak table. Friends and extended family never drew up those dark chairs to talk animatedly. When Grania and Bridget brought friends home, they took them up to their bedrooms or giggled with Nell in the kitchen. Aiden was left in the sitting room looking at television programs that he didn't want to see. Wouldn't it be better if he had his own little place, somewhere he could feel at peace? He had seen a desk that he would love in a second-hand shop, one of those marvelous desks with a flap that came down and you sat and wrote on it, as people were meant to do. And there was a nice light that came in the window here during the daytime, a soft light that they never saw. Maybe he could get a window seat or a sofa and put it there. He could have a wall with books on it and maybe tapes until he got a CD player. He could put up pictures on the wall, frescoes from Florence, or those heads, those graceful necks and heads of Leonardo da Vinci. And he could play arias to himself and read articles in magazines about the great operas. Well, this room would need more heating, but that could be seen to. And it would need some lamps. The harsh center light gave it no shadows, no mystery. There was a knock on the door. His blonde daughter Grania stood there, dressed for her date. "Are you all right, Daddy?" she asked. "Bridget said you were a bit odd. I was wondering if you were sick." "No, I'm fine," he said. but his voice seemed to come from far away, and if it seemed far to him, it must be very far to Grania. He forced a smile. "Are you going somewhere nice?" he asked. She was relieved to see him more himself. "Well, I don't know. I met a gorgeous fellow, but listen, I'll tell you about it sometime." Her face was soft, kinder than it had been for a long while. "Tell me now," he said. She shuffled. "No, I can't yet. I have to see how we get on. If there's anything to tell, you'll be the first to know." He felt unbearably sad. This girl whose hand he had held for so long, who used to laugh at his jokes and think he knew everything, and she could hardly wait to get away. "That's fine," he said. "Don't sit in here, Daddy. It's cold and lonely." He wanted to say it was cold and lonely everywhere, but he didn't. "Enjoy your night," he said. Aidan was in bed when Nell came home at 1 o'clock. The light was on, but he was not asleep. He heard the taxi pulling up outside the door. They paid for a cab home when she was on the late shift. She came into the room quietly. She had a bedside light that pointed downward at whatever book she was reading and didn't shine in his eyes. So often he'd lain there listening as she turned the pages. No words between them would ever be as interesting as the paperbacks she and her friends and sisters read. So nowadays he didn't offer them. Even tonight, when his heart was like lead and he wanted to hold her in his arms and tell her about Tony O'Brien, who was to get the headship because he was more up front, whatever that might mean, he lay there and he heard the faraway town hall clock strike the hours. At 2 o'clock, Nell put down her book with a little sigh and went to sleep as far from him on her side of the bed as if she were sleeping in the next room. And when the town hall said it was 4 o'clock, Aidan realized that Grania would have only 3 hours' sleep before she went to work. But there was nothing he could do or say. It was clearly understood that the girls lived their own lives without interrogation. He had not liked to think about it, but had accepted that they'd been to the Family Planning Association. They came home at the times that suited them, and if they did not come home, then they called at 8 o'clock during breakfast to say they were all right, that they'd stayed over with a girlfriend. This was the polite fiction that covered the Lord knew what, but, as Nell said, it was often the actual truth, and she much preferred Grania and Bridget staying in some other girl's flat than risk being driven home by a drunk or not getting a taxi in the small hours of the morning. Still, Aidan was relieved when he heard the hall door click and the light footsteps running up the stairs. At her age, she could survive on 3 hours' sleep, and it would be 3 hours more than he would have. He stood for a moment at the gates of the schoolyard. The yard was untidy, with litter blowing in the early morning breezes. The bicycle shed needed to be painted. The bikes were not properly stacked. Outside the gates, the bus stop was open and exposed to the winds. If Bus Aaron would not provide a proper bus shelter for the children who waited there after school, then the Vocational Education Committee should do so, and if they refused, a Parents' Committee would raise the funds. These were the kind of things Aidan Dunn had intended to do when he was principal. Things that would never be done now. He nodded gruffly to the children who saluted him, instead of addressing them all by name, which was his usual way, and he walked into the staff room to find no one there except Tony O'Brien, mixing a headache seltzer in a glass. "I'm getting too old for these nights," he confided to Aidan. Aidan longed to ask him why he didn't just cut them out, but that would be counterproductive. He must continue in his bland, good-natured way. "Well, I suppose all work and no play," he began. But Tony O'Brien was in no mood to hear platitudes. "Oh, I think 45 is a sort of watershed. It's half a 90, after all. It's telling you something. Not that some of us listen." He drained the glass and smacked his lips. "Was it worth it, I mean, the late night?" "Oh, who knows if it's ever worth it, Aidan. I met a nice girl. But what's the good of that, when you have to face the fourth years?" He shook his head like a dog coming out of the sea, trying to get rid of the water. And this man was going to run Mountain View College for the next 20 years, while poor old Mr. Dunn was expected to sit by and let it happen. Well, the day passed, as days always pass, whether you have a hangover like Tony O'Brien or a heavy heart like Aidan Dunn. And the next passed, and the next, Aidan still had settled on no definite plan of action. He could never find the right moment to tell them at home that his hopes of being principal had been misplaced. In fact, he thought it would be easier to say nothing until the decision was announced. Let it appear as a surprise to everyone. And he had not forgotten his plans to make himself a room. He sold the dining room table and chairs and bought the little desk. When his wife worked in Quentin's restaurant and his daughters went out on their dates, he sat and planned it for himself. Gradually, he assembled little bits of his dream. Second-hand picture frames, a low table for near the window, a big cheap sofa that fitted the space exactly. And one day he would get loose covers, something in gold or yellow, a sunny color. And he would get a square of carpet that would be a splash of some other color, orange, purple, something with life and vigor. They weren't very interested at home, so he didn't tell them his plans. In a way, he felt that his wife and daughters thought it was yet another harmless little interest for him. Evening Class, a novel by Maeve Binchy, published by Delacorte Press. Again next time on Chapter Day.